Chapter 18. On the Ice. Sometimes, as I'm falling asleep in a dark, quiet room, I have for a moment a great and treasurable illusion of the past. The wall of a tent leans up over my face, not visible but audible, a slanting plane of faint sound, the susurrus of blown snow. Nothing can be seen. The light emission of the Chabe stove is cut off, and it exists only as a sphere of heat, a heart of warmth. The faint dampness and confining cling of my sleeping bag, the sound of the snow barely audible, Estravan's breathing as he sleeps. Darkness. Nothing else. We are inside, the two of us, in shelter, at rest, at the center of all things. Outside, as always, lies the great darkness, the cold, death's solitude. In such fortunate moments as I fall asleep, I know beyond doubt what the real center of my own life is. That time that is past and lost and yet is permanent, the enduring moment, the heart of warmth. I am not trying to say that I was happy during those weeks of hauling a sledge across an ice sheet in the dead of winter. I was hungry, overstrained, and often anxious, and it all got worse the longer it went on. I certainly wasn't happy. Happiness has to do with reason, and only reason earns it. What I was given was the thing you can't earn and can't keep and often don't even recognize at the time. I mean joy. I always woke up first, usually before daylight. My metabolic rate is slightly over the Gathenian norm, as are my height and weight. Estravan had figured these differences into the food ration calculations in his scrupulous way, which one could see as either housewifely or scientific. And from the start, I had had a couple of ounces more food per day than he. Protests of injustice fell silent before the self-evident justice of this unequal division. However divided, the share was small. I was hungry, constantly hungry, daily hungrier. I woke up because I was hungry. If it was still dark, I turned up the light of the Chabe stove and put a pan of ice brought in the night before, now thawed, on the stove to boil. Estravan, meanwhile, engaged in his customary fierce and silent struggle with sleep, as if he wrestled with an angel. Winning, he sat up, stared at me vaguely, shook his head, and woke. By the time we were dressed and booted and had the bags rolled up, breakfast was ready. A mug of boiling hot orsh and one cube of gichi-michi expanded by hot water into a sort of small, doughy bun. We chewed slowly, solemnly, retrieving all dropped crumbs. The stove cooled as we ate. We packed it up with the pan and mugs, pulled on our hooded overcoats and our mittens, and crawled out into the open air. The coldness of it was perpetually incredible. Every morning I had to believe it all over again. If one had been outside to relieve oneself already, the second exit was only harder. Sometimes it was snowing, sometimes the long light of early day lay wonderfully gold and blue across the miles of ice. Most often it was gray. We brought the thermometer into the tent with us nights, and when we took it outside it was interesting to watch the pointer swing to the right. Gathenian dials read counterclockwise, almost too fast to follow, registering a drop of 25, 50, 80 degrees, till it stopped somewhere between 0 and -60. One of us collapsed the tent and folded it, while the other loaded stove, bags, etc., onto the sledge. The tent was strapped over all, and we were ready for skis and harness. Little metal was used in our straps and fittings, but the harnesses had buckles of aluminum alloy, too fine to fasten with mittens on, which burned in that cold exactly as if they were red-hot. I had to be very careful of my fingers when the temperature was below -20, especially if the wind blew, for I could pick up a frostbite amazingly fast. My feet never suffered, and that is a factor of major importance in a winter journey where an hour's exposure can, after all, cripple one for a week or for life. Estravan had had to guess my size, and the snow boots he got me were a little large, but extra socks filled the discrepancy. We put on our skis, got into harness as quick as possible, bucked and pried and jolted the sledge free if its runners were frozen in, and set off. Mornings after heavy snowfall, we might have to spend some while digging out the tent and sledge before we could set off. The new snow was not hard to shovel away, though it made great impressive drifts around us, who were, after all, the only impediment for hundreds of miles, the only thing sticking out above the ice. We pulled eastward by the compass. The usual direction of the wind was north to south, off the glacier. Day after day it blew from our left as we went. The hood did not suffice against that wind, and I wore a facial mask to protect my nose and left cheek. Even so, my left eye froze shut one day, and I thought I had lost the use of it. Even when Esrafen thawed it open with breath and tongue, I could not see with it for some while, so probably more had been frozen than the lashes. In sunlight, both of us wore the Guthenian slit-screen eye shields, and neither of us suffered any snow blindness. We had small opportunity. The ice, as Esrafen had said, tends to hold a high-pressure zone above its central area where thousands of square miles of white reflect the sunlight. We were not in this central zone, however, but at best on the edge of it, between it and the zone of turbulent, deflected, precipitation-laden storms that it sends continually to torment the subglacial lands. Wind from due north brought bare, bright weather, but from northeast or northwest it brought snow, or harrowed up dry fallen snow into blinding, biting clouds like sand or dust storms, or else, sinking almost to nothing, crept in sinuous trails along the surface, leaving the sky white, the air white, no visible sun, no shadow, and the snow itself, the ice, disappeared from under our feet. Around midday we would halt and cut and set up a few blocks of ice for a protective wall if the wind was strong. We heated water to soak a cube of gitchy-mitchy in, and drank the water hot, sometimes with a bit of sugar melted in it, harnessed up again and went on. We seldom talked while on the march or at lunch, for our lips were sore, and when one's mouth was open the cold got inside, hurting teeth and throat and lungs. It was necessary to keep the mouth closed and breathe through the nose, at least when the air was 40 or 50 degrees below freezing. When it went on lower than that, the whole breathing process was further complicated by the rapid freezing of one's exhaled breath. If you didn't look out, your nostrils might freeze shut, and then, to keep from suffocating, you would gasp in a lungful of razors. Under certain conditions, our exhalations freezing instantly made a tiny cracking noise like distant firecrackers, and a shower of crystals, each breath a snowstorm. We pulled till we were tired out, or till it began to grow dark, halted, set up the tent, pegged down the sledge if there was threat of high wind, and settled in for the night. On a usual day we would have pulled for 11 or 12 hours and made between 12 and 18 miles. It does not seem a very good rate, but then conditions were a bit adverse. The crust of the snow was seldom right for both skis and sledge runners. When it was light and new, the sledge ran through rather than over it. When it was partly hardened, the sledge would stick, but we on skis would not, which meant that we were perpetually being pulled up backward with a jolt, and when it was hard it was often heaped up in long wind waves, sastrugi, that in some places ran up to 4 feet high. We had to haul the sledge up and over each knife-edged or fantastically corniced top, then slither down and up over the next one, for they never seemed to run parallel to our course. I had imagined the Gobern ice plateau to be all one sheet like a frozen pond, but there were hundreds of miles of it that were rather like an abruptly frozen, storm-raised sea. The business of setting up camp, making everything secure, getting all the clinging snow off one's outer clothing and so on, was trying. Sometimes it did not seem worthwhile. It was so late, so cold, one was so tired that it would be much easier to lie down in a sleeping bag in the lee of the sledge and not bother with the tent. I remember how clear this was to me on certain evenings, and how bitterly I resented my companion's methodical, tyrannical insistence that we do everything and do it correctly and thoroughly. I hated him at such times, with a hatred that rose straight up out of the death that lay within my spirit. I hated the harsh, intricate, obstinate demands that he made on me in the name of life. When all was done, we could enter the tent, and almost at once the heat of the Chabe stove could be felt as an enveloping, protecting ambience. A marvelous thing surrounded us. Warmth. Death and cold were elsewhere, outside. Hatred was also left outside. We ate and drank. After we ate, we talked. When the cold was extreme, even the excellent insulation of the tent could not keep it out, and we lay in our bags as close to the stove as possible. A little fur of frost gathered on the inner surface of the tent. To open the valve was to let in a draft of cold that instantly condensed, filling the tent with a swirling mist of fine snow. When there was a blizzard, needles of icy air blew in through the vents, elaborately protected as they were, and an impalpable dust of snow motes fogged the air. On those nights, the storm made an incredible noise, and we could not converse by voice unless we shouted with our heads together. On other nights it was still, with such a stillness as one imagines as existing before the stars begin to form, or after everything has perished. Within an hour after our evening meal, Estravan turned the stove down, if it was feasible to do so, and turned the light emission off. As he did so, he murmured a short and charming grace of invocation, the only ritual words I had ever learned of the Hundara. "Praise, then, darkness and creation unfinished," he said. And there was darkness. We slept. In the morning, it was all to do over. We did it over for 50 days. Estravan kept up his journal, though during the weeks on the ice he seldom wrote more than a note of the weather and the distance we had come that day. Among these notes there is occasional mention of his own thoughts or of some of our conversation, but not a word concerning the profounder conversation between us that occupied our rest between dinner and sleep on many nights of the first month on the ice, while we still had enough energy to talk and on certain days that we spent storm-bound in the tent. I told him that I was not forbidden, but not expected, to use paraverbal speech on a non-ally planet, and asked him to keep what he learned from his own people at least until I could discuss what I had done with my colleagues on the ship. He assented and kept his word. He never said or wrote anything concerning our silent conversations. Mind speech was the only thing I had to give Estravan out of all my civilization, my alien reality in which he was so profoundly interested. I could talk and describe endlessly, but that was all I had to give. Indeed, it may be the only important thing we have to give to Winter. But I can't say that gratitude was my motive for infringing on the law of cultural embargo. I was not paying my debt to him. Such debts remain owing. Estravan and I had simply arrived at the point where we shared whatever we had that was worth sharing. I expect it will turn out that sexual intercourse is possible between Githinian double-sexed and Hainish norm one-sexed human beings, though such intercourse will inevitably be sterile. It remains to be proved. Estravan and I proved nothing except perhaps a rather subtler point. The nearest to crisis that our sexual desires brought us was on a night early in the journey, our second night up on the ice. We had spent all day struggling and backtracking in the cut-up, crevassed area east of the Fire Hills. We were tired that evening, but elated, sure that a clear course would soon open out ahead. But after dinner, Estravan grew taciturn and cut my talk off short. I said at last, after a direct rebuff, "Harth, I've said something wrong again. Please tell me what it is." He was silent. "I've made some mistake in Shifgrethor. I'm sorry. I can't learn. I've never even really understood the meaning of the word."
"Shifgrethor?"
"It comes from an old word for shadow." We were both silent for a little, and then he looked at me with a direct, gentle gaze. His face, in the reddish light, was as soft, as vulnerable, as remote as the face of a woman who looks at you out of her thoughts and does not speak. And I saw then, again and for good, what I had always been afraid to see and had pretended not to see in him, that he was a woman as well as a man. Any need to explain the sources of that fear vanished with the fear. What I was left with was, at last, acceptance of him as he was. Until then I had rejected him, refused him his own reality. He had been quite right to say that he, the only person on Gethin who trusted me, was the only Gethinian I distrusted. For he was the only one who had entirely accepted me as a human being, who had liked me personally and given me entire personal loyalty, and who therefore had demanded of me an equal degree of recognition, of acceptance. I had not been willing to give it. I had been afraid to give it. I had not wanted to give my trust, my friendship, to a man who was a woman. A woman who was a man. He explained stiffly and simply that he was in Kemmer and had been trying to avoid me insofar as one of us could avoid the other. "I must not touch you," he said, with extreme constraint. Saying that, he looked away. I said, "I understand. I agree completely." For it seemed to me, and I think to him, that it was from that sexual tension between us, admitted now and understood, but not assuaged, that the great and sudden assurance of friendship between us rose. A friendship so much needed by us both in our exile, and already so well proved in the days and nights of our bitter journey that it might as well be called, now as later, love. But it was from the difference between us, not from the affinities and likenesses, but from the difference that that love came. And it was itself the bridge, the only bridge, across what divided us. For us to meet sexually would be for us to meet once more as aliens. We had touched in the only way we could touch. We left it at that. I do not know if we were right. We talked some more that night, and I recall being very hard put to it to answer coherently when he asked me what women were like. We were both rather stiff and cautious with each other for the next couple of days. A profound love between two people involves, after all, the power and chance of doing profound hurt. It would never have occurred to me before that night that I could hurt Esraven. Now that the barriers were down, the limitation in my terms of our converse and understanding seemed intolerable to me. Quite soon, two or three nights later, I said to my companion, as we finished our dinner, a special treat, sugared kaitik porridge, to celebrate a 20-mile run. "Last spring, that night in the corner red dwelling, you said you wished I'd tell you more about paraverbal speech."
"Yes, I did."
"You want to see if I can teach you how to speak it?" He laughed.
"You want to catch me lying?"
"If you ever lied to me, it was long ago, and in another country." He was an honest person, but rarely a direct one. That tickled him, and he said, "In another country I may tell you other lies. But I thought you were forbidden to teach your mind science to the natives until we joined the Ecumen." "Not forbidden. It's not done. I'll do it, though, if you like. And if I can, I'm no educer."
"There are special teachers of the skill?"
"Yes. Not on Altera, where there's a high occurrence of natural sensitivity, and, they say, mothers' minds speak to their unborn babies. I don't know what the babies answer, but most of us have to be taught as if it were a foreign language. Or rather, as if it were our native language, but learned very late." I think he understood my motive in offering to teach him the skill, and he wanted very much to learn it. We had a go at it. I recalled what I could of how I had been educed at age 12.
I told him to clear his mind. Let it be dark. This he did, no doubt, more promptly and thoroughly than I ever had done. He was an adept of the Hundara, after all. Then I mind-spoke to him as clearly as I could. No result. We tried it again. Since one cannot bespeak until one has been bespoken, until the telepathic potentiality has been sensitized by one clear reception. I had to get through to him first. I tried for half an hour, till I felt hoarse of brain. He looked crestfallen. "I thought it would be easy for me," he confessed. We were both tired out, and called the attempt off for the night. Our next efforts were no more successful. I tried sending to Estravan while he slept, recalling what my inducer had told me about the occurrence of dream messages among pre-telepathic peoples, but it did not work.
"Perhaps my species lacks the capacity," he said. "We have enough rumors and hints to have made up a word for the power, but I don't know of any proven instances of telepathy among us."
So it was with my people for thousands of years. A few natural sensitives, not comprehending their gift, and lacking anyone to receive from or send to. All the rest, latent, if that. You know, I told you that, except in the case of the born sensitive, the capacity, though it has a physiological basis, is a psychological one. A product of culture, a side effect of the use of the mind. Young children and defectives and members of unevolved or regressed societies can't mind-speak. The mind must exist on a certain plane of complexity first. You can't build up amino acids out of hydrogen atoms. A good deal of complexifying has to take place first. The same situation. Abstract thought, varied social interaction, intricate cultural adjustments, aesthetic and ethical perception, all of it has to reach a certain level before the connections can be made, before the potentiality can be touched at all.
Perhaps we Gathenians haven't attained that level.
You're far beyond it. But luck is involved, as in the creation of amino acids. Or to take analogies on the cultural plane, only analogies, but they illuminate the scientific method, for instance, the use of concrete experimental techniques in science. There are peoples of the Ecumen who possess a high culture, a complex society, philosophies, arts, ethics, a high style, and a great achievement in all those fields, and yet they have never learned to weigh a stone accurately. They can learn how, of course. Only for half a million years they never did. There are peoples who have no higher mathematics at all, nothing beyond the simplest applied arithmetic. Every one of them is capable of understanding the calculus, but not one of them does, or ever has. As a matter of fact, my own people, the Terrans, were ignorant until about 3,000 years ago of the uses of zero. That made Estravan blink. As for Gethin, what I'm curious about is whether the rest of us may find ourselves to have the capacity for foretelling. Whether this, too, is a part of the evolution of the mind, if you'll teach us the techniques.
You think it a useful accomplishment?
Accurate prophecy? Well, of course.
You might have come to believe that it's a useless one in order to practice it.
Your Hundara fascinates me, Harth. But now and then I wonder if it isn't simply paradox developed into a way of life. We tried mind speech again. I had never before sent repeatedly to a total non-receiver. The experience was disagreeable. I began to feel like an atheist praying. Presently Estravan yawned and said, "I am deaf, deaf as a rock. We'd better sleep." I assented. He turned out the light, murmuring his brief praise of darkness. We burrowed down into our bags, and within a minute or two he was sliding into sleep as a swimmer slides into dark water. I felt his sleep as if it were my own. The emphatic bond was there, and once more I bespoke him sleepily by his name, Theram. He sat bolt upright,
for his voice rang out above me in the blackness, loud. "Arak, is that you?"
"No, Genli Ai. I am bespeaking you."
His breath caught. Silence. He fumbled with the Chabe stove, turned up the light, stared at me with his dark eyes full of fear.
"I dreamed," he said. "I thought I was at home."
"You heard me mind speak.
You called me. It was my brother. It was his voice I heard. He's dead. You called me. You called me Theram. This is more terrible than I thought."
He shook his head as a man will do to shake off a nightmare and then put his face in his hands.
"Arth, I'm very sorry." "No, call me by name. If you can speak inside my skull with a dead man's voice, then you can call me by my name. Would he have called me Arth? Oh, I see why there's no lying in this mind speech. It is a terrible thing." "All right. All right, speak to me again."
"Wait."
"No, go on."
With his fierce, frightened gaze on me, I bespoke him. "Theram, my friend, there's nothing to fear between us." He kept on staring at me, so I thought he had not understood, but he had.
"Ah, but there is," he said.
After a while, controlling himself, he said calmly, "You spoke in my language."
"Well, you don't know mine."
"You said there would be words. I know, yet I imagined it as an understanding."
"Empathy's another game, though not unconnected. It gave us the connection tonight. But in mind speech proper, the speech centers of the brain are activated as well as—"
"No, no, no, tell me that later. Why do you speak in my brother's voice?"
His voice was strained.
"That I can't answer. I don't know."
"Tell me about him."
"Nuthuth. My full brother, Arak Harthrem Ereshkigal. He was a year older than I. He would have been lord of Esther. I left home, you know, for his sake. He's been dead 14 years.
We were both silent for some time. I could not know or ask what lay behind his words. It had cost him too much to say the little he had said. I said at last, "Bespeak me, Theram. Call me by my name." I knew he could. The rapport was there, or as the experts have it, the phases were consonant. And of course he had as yet no idea of how to raise the barrier voluntarily. Had I been a listener, I could have heard him think.
"No," he said. "Never. Not yet."
But no amount of shock, awe, terror could restrain that insatiable, outreaching mind for long. After he had cut out the light again, I suddenly heard his stammer in my inward hearing, "Genri." Even mind-speaking, he never could say L properly. I replied at once. In the dark he made an inarticulate sound of fear that had in it a slight edge of satisfaction.
"No more, no more," he said aloud.
After a while we got to sleep at last. It never came easy to him. Not that he lacked the gift or could not develop the skill, but it disturbed him profoundly, and he could not take it for granted. He quickly learned to set up the barriers, but I'm not sure he felt he could count on them. Perhaps all of us were so, when the first educers came back centuries ago from Wakanan's world, teaching the last art to us. Perhaps a Gathenian, being singularly complete, feels telepathic speech as a violation of completeness, a breach of integrity hard for him to tolerate. Perhaps it was Estraven's own character in which candor and reserve were both strong. Every word he said rose out of a deeper silence. He heard my voice bespeaking him as a dead man's, his brother's voice. I did not know what besides love and death lay between him and that brother, but I knew that whenever I bespoke him, something in him winced away as if I touched a wound. So that intimacy of mind established between us was a bond indeed, but an obscure and austere one, not so much admitting further light, as I had expected it to, as showing the extent of the darkness. And day after day we crept on eastward over the plain of ice. the midpoint in time of our journey as planned, the 35th day, Adorni Anner found us far short of our halfway point in space. By the sledge meter, we had indeed traveled about 400 miles, but probably only three-quarters of that was real forward gain, and we could estimate only very roughly how far still remained to go. We had spent days, miles, rations in our long struggle to get up onto the ice. Estevan was not so worried as I by the hundreds of miles that still lay ahead of us. "The sledge is lighter," he said. "Towards the end it will be still lighter, and we can cut rations if necessary. We have been eating very well, you know." I thought he was being ironic, but I should have known better. On the 40th day and the two succeeding, we were snowed in by a blizzard. During these long hours of lying blotto in the tent, Estevan slept almost continuously and ate nothing, though he drank orsh or sugar water at mealtimes. He insisted that I eat, though only half rations. "You have no experience in starvation," he said. I was humiliated. "How much have you, lord of a domain and prime minister?" "Genry, we practice privation until we're experts at it. I was taught how to starve as a child, at home in Estra, and by the Handarata in Rother of Fastness. I got out of practice in Erenrang, true enough, but I began making up for it in Mishnori. Please do as I say, my friend. I know what I'm doing." He did, and I did. We went on for 4 more days of very bitter cold, never above minus 25 degrees, and then came another blizzard whooping up in our faces from the east on a gale wind. Within 2 minutes of the first strong gust, the snow blew so thick that I could not see Estevan 6 feet away. I had turned my back on him and the sledge, and the plastering, blinding, suffocating snow in order to get my breath, and when a minute later I turned around, he was gone. The sledge was gone. Nothing was there. I took a few steps to where they had been and felt about. I shouted and could not hear my own voice. I was deaf and alone in a universe filled solid with small, stinging gray streaks. I panicked and began to blunder forward, mind calling frantically, "Theram!" Right under my hand, kneeling, he said, "Come on, give me a hand with the tent." I did so. I never mentioned my minute of panic. No need to. This blizzard lasted 2 days. There were 5 days lost, and there would be more. Nimmer and Anner are the months of the great storms. "We're beginning to cut it rather fine, aren't we?" I said one night as I measured out our gitchy-mitchy ration and put it to soak in hot water. He looked at me. His firm, broad face showed weight loss in deep shadows under the cheekbones. His eyes were sunken, and his mouth sorely chapped and cracked. God knows what I looked like when he looked like that. He smiled. "With luck we shall make it, and without luck we shall not." It was what he had said from the start. With all my anxieties, my sense of taking a last desperate gamble and so on, I had not been realistic enough to believe him. Even now I thought, surely, when we've worked so hard. But the ice did not know how hard we worked. Why should it? Proportion is kept. "How is your luck running, Theram?" I said at last. He did not smile at that, nor did he answer. Only after a while he said, "I've been thinking about them all down there." Down there for us had come to mean the south, the world below the plateau of ice, the region of earth, men, roads, cities, all of which had become hard to imagine as really existing. "You know that I sent word to the king concerning you the day I left Mishnori. I told him what Shuskis told me, that you were going to be sent to Polevin Farm. At the time I wasn't clear as to my intent, but merely followed my impulse. I have thought the impulse through since. Something like this may happen. The king will see a chance to play Chifgrethor. Tai will advise against it, but Argiven should be growing a little tired of Tai by now, and may ignore his counsel. He will inquire. Where is the envoy, the guest of Karhide? Mishnori will lie. He died of horn fever this autumn, most lamentable. Then how does it happen that we are informed by our own embassy that he's in Puleffin Farm?
He's not there, look for yourselves.
No, no, of course not. We accept the word of the commensals of Orgorain.
But a few weeks after these exchanges, the envoy appears in North Carhide, having escaped from Puleffin Farm. Consternation in Mishnori, indignation in Erenrang, loss of face for the commensals, caught lying. You will be a treasure, a long-lost hearth-brother to King Arcanon, Henry. For a while. You must send for your starship at once, at the first chance you get. Bring your people to Carhide, and accomplish your mission at once before Argaven has had time to see the possible enemy in you, before Tybe or some other counselor frightens him once more, playing on his madness. If he makes the bargain with you, he will keep it. To break it would be to break his own ship, Grethor. The Harge kings keep their promises, but you must act fast, and bring the ship down soon.
I will, if I receive the slightest sign of welcome.
No, forgive my advising you, but you must not wait for welcome. You will be welcomed, I think. So will the ship. Carhide has been sorely humbled this past year. You will give Argaven the chance to turn the tables.
I think he will take the chance.
Very well, but you, meanwhile, I am Estravan the traitor. I have nothing whatever to do with you.
At first.
At first, he agreed.
You'll be able to hide out if there is danger at first?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Our food was ready, and we fell to. Eating was so important and engrossing a business that we never talked any more while we ate. The taboo was now in its complete, perhaps its original form. Not a word said till the last crumb was gone. When it was, he said,
"Well, I hope I've guessed well.
You do forgive your giving me direct advice?" I said, for there were certain things I had finally come to understand.
"Of course I do, Theron.
Really, how can you doubt it? You know I have no Shiv Grethor to wave." That amused him, but he was still brooding.
"Why,"
he said at last, "why did you come alone? Why were you sent alone? Everything still will depend upon that ship coming. Why was it made so difficult for you and for us?"
"It's the Acumen's custom, and there are reasons for it, though in fact I begin to wonder if I've ever understood the reasons. I thought it was for your sake that I came alone, so obviously alone, so vulnerable that I could in myself post no threat, change no balance, not an invasion but a mere messenger boy. But there's more to it than that. Alone, I cannot change your world, but I can be changed by it. Alone, I must listen as well as speak. Alone, the relationship I finally make, if I make one, is not impersonal and not only political, it is individual. It is personal. It is both more and less than political. Not we and they, not I and it, but I and thou. Not political, not pragmatic, but mystical. In a certain sense, the Ecumen is not a body politic, but a body mystic. It considers beginnings to be extremely important. Beginnings and means. Its doctrine is just the reverse of the doctrine that the end justifies the means. It proceeds, therefore, by subtle ways and slow ones, and queer, risky ones, rather as evolution does, which is, in certain senses, its model. So I was sent alone, for your sake or for my own, I don't know. Yes, it has made things difficult. But I might ask you, as profitably, why you've never seen fit to invent airborne vehicles. One small stolen airplane would have spared you and me a great deal of difficulty. How would it ever occur to a sane man that he could fly?
Estravan said sternly.
It was a fair response, on a world where no living thing is winged, and the very angels of the Yomesh hierarchy of the Holy do not fly, but only drift, wingless, down to earth like a soft snow falling, like the wind-borne seeds of that flowerless world. Towards the middle of Nimmer, after much wind and bitter cold, we came into a quiet weather for many days. If there were a storm, it was far south of us, down there, and we inside the blizzard had only an all but windless overcast. At first the overcast was thin, so that the air was vaguely radiant with an even sourceless sunlight reflected from both clouds and snow,
from above and below. Overnight the weather thickened somewhat. All brightness was gone, leaving nothing. We stepped out of the tent onto nothing. Sledge and tent were there. Estevan stood beside me, but neither he nor I cast any shadow. There was dull light all around, everywhere. When we walked on the crisp snow, no shadow showed the footprint. We left no track. Sledge, tent, himself, myself, nothing else at all. No sun, no sky, no horizon, no world. A whitish-gray void in which we appeared to hang. The illusion was so complete that I had trouble keeping my balance. My inner ears were used to confirmation from my eyes as to how I stood. They got none. I might as well be blind. It was all right while we loaded up, but hauling, with nothing ahead, nothing to look at, nothing for the eye to touch, as it were, it was at first disagreeable and then exhausting. We were on skis, on a good surface of fern without sastrugi, and solid, that was certain, for 5,000 or 6,000 feet down. We should have been making good time. But we kept slowing down, groping our way across the totally unobstructed plain, and it took a strong effort of will to speed up to a normal pace. Every slight variation in the surface came as a jolt, as in climbing stairs, the unexpected stair or the expected but absent stair, for we could not see it ahead. There was no shadow to show it. We skied blind, with our eyes open. Day after day was like this, and we began to shorten our hauls, for by mid-afternoon both of us would be sweating and shaking with strain and fatigue. I came to long for snow, for blizzard, for anything. But morning after morning we came out of the tent into the void, the white weather, what Estevan called the unshadow. One day about noon, Odorni Nimmer, the 61st day of the journey, that bland, blind nothingness about us, began to flow and writhe. I thought my eyes were fooling me, as they had been doing often, and paid scant attention to the dim, meaningless commotion of the air until suddenly I caught a glimpse of a small, wan, dead sun overhead. And looking down from the sun, straight ahead, I saw a huge black shape come hulking out of the void towards us. Black tentacles writhed upwards, groping out. I stopped dead in my tracks, slewing Estevan around on his skis, for we were both in harness hauling. "What is it?" He stared at the dark, monstrous forms hidden in the fog, and said at last, "The crags. It must be Esherhoth Crags," and pulled on. We were miles from the things, which I had taken to be almost within arm's reach. As the white weather turned to a thick, low mist and then cleared off, we saw them plainly before sunset. Nunataks, great scored and ravaged pinnacles of rock jutting up out of the ice, no more of them showing than shows of an iceberg above the sea. Cold, drowned mountains, dead for eons. They showed us to be somewhat north of our shortest course, if we could trust the ill-drawn map that was all we had. The next day we turned, for the first time a little south of east.